Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe on WVKR. I'm your host, Thomas Hill. Today I'll be talking with Jessica Breyer, Decanatel Curatorial Fellow in Photography at the Francis Lehman Loeb Art Center here at Vassar College. Jessica is going to be talking with us about the exhibition she has curated and that will be on view at the Loeb Center through December 22nd. The exhibition is entitled On the Grid, Ways of Seeing in Print. And I'll start the interview talking with Jessica in her office here, after which we'll take a kind of ekphrastic tour of the show through the galleries with a handheld recorder. Welcome, Jessica. Your first time on our show. This is great.
So, thank you so much for having me.
I'm really pleased you're here. So, first question, how did you come to use John Berger's phrase, Ways of Seeing, for the exhibition subtitle? Great program, by the way, if you've ever seen the BBC production.
Amazing. Definitely recommend it. The show is essentially about how grids often structure our perception, especially in printed forms, and many of the works of art in the show center perception itself as a subject. And they ask us to think critically about how we see. Sometimes we look actively, and other times we see through or past certain things. And perception isn't just about processing the world visually, but the way we see informs and is informed by our worldviews. So seeing is visual, but it's also a function of the mind and the body. It's informed by our experiences, emotions, ideas, memories. So John Berger was really important to me in thinking about this. In his words, every image embodies a way of seeing. And he's so important for articulating how seeing is not innate, but it's something that we learn, a learned behavior, something that's conditioned by the environment, the culture, our own personal experiences. And he's written and talked about how images are as instructive as they are illustrative. So they tell us how to look as much as they show us what to look at, right? So he was instrumental in popularizing the idea of the male gaze, looking at European painting and advertising, and emphasized the role of photography in particular, especially in advertising, in shaping a capitalist worldview in the West. So all of these ideas were really foundational for the show.
Sounds fascinating. So I should mention, for those who can't make it to the exhibit, that there's an illustrated catalog to the exhibition about to come out, published by Scala Arts Publishers, that one can order through accartbooks.com. And since the catalog is something of a work of art in itself, I wonder if you can tell us, just to start, you know, what went into producing and designing the catalog, because it really is a wonderful catalog.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm very excited about the book. It really was a true collaboration. Of course, the research, writing, and the design of the book all really contribute to its presence. There are two essays, my own introductory essay, a real overview of the themes of the exhibition, and then John Murphy's excellent essay, The Print After Photography. And I think we'll get into that a little bit later, so I'll save it. There are also eight shorter texts written by eight of the artists whose work is featured in the show. And each of them respond to this rather broad, esoteric question, what kind of way of seeing is the grid? So I posed that question to each one of them. They all answered it somewhat differently and just did an amazing job of kind of encapsulating all of these different ways of thinking about the grid and perception in print. And then there are entries on each one of the 59 artworks in the exhibition. Those were written by John Murphy, myself, and our amazing intern, Massimo Tariras, who graduated from Vassar in 2022. And, you know, we really wanted the book to be a kind of source book for all of the works that are in the collection.
Wonderful catalog entries.
Thanks. And then none of this would really have come together without our book designer, Beverly Joel.
Wonderful design, graphic design.
She did an amazing job. She created a grid-based custom typeface for the show made of 32 variants from a single typeface family, Muir McNeil's Intersect, for those who are interested, and made these kind of different variations on line and dot patterns that kind of evoke this idea of disorientation and reorientation of perception.
It seems so, almost an artist book itself in the design.
I love the design so much.
Wonderful. So the fact that we do have this beautifully designed catalog with all the research that went into it underscores the fact that the exhibition has an important contribution to make to the literature of the history of art and of printmaking in particular. This is a theme show about grids on works of paper. And by a theme show, I mean it's not about an individual artist or a period. Mm-hmm. But this is a somewhat overlooked theme that you really drill into in this exhibition. So can you talk about why the role of the grid in art, important as it is, tends to use a phrase from your catalog to hide in plain sight?
Yeah, so emphasis in American art history on grids has tended to really focus on abstract painting. Uh-huh. So there was quite a bit of attention to minimalist painting by figures like Rosalind Krauss and John Elderfield, mm-hmm. and their writing on the grid has become so important and canonical that it seemed in some ways to foreclose future study of that topic, which is ironic because they were interested in that topic in the 1970s, thinking about contemporary artists, and then Krauss especially used that as a framework to think about historical works in a different way. And in some ways, I'm taking a similar approach with this exhibition. So partly I was drawn to the topic because of the role that it has had in art history, but not so much in historicizing works on paper. So I think the lack of attention to the grid in print, in works on paper, has partly been a consequence of studying and collecting photographs and prints as these very separate media.
Very interesting.
And of course, art historians have distinct areas of specialization, and sometimes this is along the lines of medium, oftentimes that's the case. But there's real value in studying these media together, in part because their histories are so overlapping. So I'm interested in those overlaps. And when we look at how the histories of art and technology intersect, we see that photography and printmaking are actually not as cleanly distinct as they seem.
Yeah.
So one goal of the show is to encourage more of this kind of research and scholarship.
Yeah, one of my questions was going to be, are print curators as territorial as they used to be about not letting photographs in under the fence? But
yeah, I think this is a nice example of that not being the case.
Yeah.
Both John Murphy and I, John is the Strauss curator of prints and drawings at the Loeb, and a great collaborator on the exhibition, and both of us, I think, have a real interest in this intersection of histories of photography and printmaking.
So I know John has invested in the show a lot. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how the show came together and the research and collaboration that went into both planning and executing the show? I mean, who you work with, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. So certainly John was a great collaborator, mm-hmm. wrote an excellent essay, and just helped me think through the integration of prints with other kinds of objects like photographs and artist books and sculptures. And it really began for me with getting to know the collection in depth. What I found when I started to explore were these unexpected connections between different artists, movements, and times. This is what a really deep collection allows, right?
Yeah.
And it inspired me to think about the Loeb's collection of photography in terms of how it could be integrated into broader stories of modernity, modernism, postmodernism through the collection. Mm-hmm. So there was, as I've said, a lot of collaboration through the research and writing for the show.
Yeah.
And then, of course, almost every aspect of any exhibition is collaborative.
Yeah.
So, you know, from design and editing of the book, as we talked about, to the texts on the walls, planning and execution of the installation. I really want to acknowledge my colleagues, our preparators, Eleanor White and Diane Tenorelli, who did an amazing job of helping to bring this show to life.
Yeah, it's beautiful when you walk into the gallery. Really stunning.
They did an incredible job.
I love text on the walls, too, and lately we've seen a lot of that, aphorisms.
Everyone who contributed to the show really helped to bring it to life in really important ways, and really even after the installation to our guides, our guards, everyone who interfaces with the public and increases the accessibility of the project.
Did you have to do any grant writing?
I did.
Yeah, you did. Okay. Yeah.
Grant writing is not always successful, but it does help to hone the arguments of a project.
Yeah, it helps to publish a catalog too sometimes.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, great. And you're new to the Loeb, so your vision of this collection is kind of a new vision. So that's wonderful, and that you were able to pull so much out of the collection on your first pass, in a way, through it, right?
Mm-hmm.
It seems like So one question that comes up, how does it come to be that we have so many great examples of contemporary artworks, including photography? I don't know if you've researched the history of the collection. Bart Thurber writes about it in his introduction to the catalog. Mm-hmm. But we do have a wonderful collection, don't we, of works on paper, sort of generally photographs and prints. So.
Absolutely. And collecting contemporary art has always been an important part of building this collection.
Yeah.
And currently, contemporary art incorporating or based in photography is a big part of our current acquisition program.
Uh-huh.
So contemporary artists are using photography in really interesting ways and pushing the boundaries of the medium through technical and conceptual experimentation. And this is an area that we're really excited about in terms of growing the collection. So, for example, the show includes recent acquisitions of works by Stephanie Sajuko, Aaron Turner, Allison Rossiter, and Leslie Hewitt, who are all incredibly important contemporary artists. And each of their work engages with histories of photography, histories of art that speak to the strengths of the collection, but also expand its capacity and bring more perspectives on things like race, immigration, globalization, and other aspects of human experience.
You also have very well-known modernists in it, don't you? I mean,
yes.
There are famous names all over the gallery there, aren't there? From Duchamp to Kitai to...
Yeah, Roy Lichtenstein, Saul DeWitt, Frank Stella. And that was a goal, too, was to really bring works by unknown or less known artists and very contemporary artists who are working right now together in conversation with these kind of canonical figures.
Oh, yeah.
People like Edward Muybridge,
wonderful series that is you've got. Also, these works are in conversation with works in the permanent collection, aren't they? I mean, we've got works kind of close by that are based on the grid.
Plenty of other examples in the galleries.
Yeah.
So it becomes a bit of an Easter egg hunt once you go through the show.
Martin comes to the adjacent gallery.
Yeah.
And you can almost defy the idea of a grid with that painting, you know. So wonderful anyway. So the show really talks to the rest of the art in the collection,
which is
wonderful.
Yeah.
So I wonder, you cite two inventions in the 19th century, one of them being photography, that both affect certainly the content of this exhibit and are directly related to the adoption of the grid into our cultural framework as a way of doing art and as a way of seeing. And I wonder if you could talk about this sort of period of invention when photography takes off.
Sure. So the invention of photography, a little difficult to pinpoint, but let's say for the purpose of our conversation, 1839.
Uh-huh.
And then right around the same time, the invention of the rotary printing press comes about. So circa 1840, we have these two inventions, and I find that coincidence of those inventions really illustrative of how intertwined photography and printing are. So both were really key for ushering in this modern era of information circulation through printed matter.
Mm-hmm.
So photography was a medium that was used to really radically shape ideas about the world, especially as a means for studying and illustrating scientific phenomena, organizing information of all kinds, and for being able to mass circulate and consume those ideas. And then at the same time, the rotary press made it possible to print much more quickly and cheaply than had been the case before, enabling the printing of newspapers on a weekly or daily basis eventually, and really transformed books into household objects.
Uh-huh.
So turned the print into really a household ephemeral object that anyone could have.
Magazine publishing takes off at the same time.
Exactly.
Everybody can afford to subscribe to magazines and they have images in them. So,
exactly.
Wonderful. So Maria Mitchell, I just discovered, invented the mechanism that allowed one to take a photograph in the 1860s from a telescope, and then she used that herself to document the movement of sunspots across the face of the sun, and
then
she developed a theory of sunspots that holds water even today.
Yeah.
So I thought that was rather remarkable. I know there was somebody in geology here in the early days of photography too who was going on archaeological expeditions with cameras, and he developed a whole big archive of geological images. So this plays a big part in the development of science in the 19th century.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I mean, so much of photography's early history doesn't have much to do with art. It certainly is always in conversation with art, and I don't mean to say that it isn't, of course, but most of photography's early applications were in lots of other fields.
So what about halftone printing when it comes in? That's a big deal, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. So as soon as photography was invented, practitioners began immediately trying to figure out how to reproduce photographs. Photography was invented as a way of making new images, but then how could those images be reproduced and circulated? So obviously photography doesn't circulate as images made in the darkroom, but of course in print, and today obviously on screens. So by about the year 1880, the halftone process was invented and became used widely. And it effectively translates the photograph into a screen-printed image that can be printed alongside text. So when we look at a photograph printed as a halftone, what we're actually looking at is a grid of tiny dots that are so small we can't usually see them. They appear as one coherent image through optical illusion. So this is one of the ways that we see the grid, usually without really looking at it, when we read images in print. Another example of this is the typographic grid, the idea of organizing information on a page or on the screen according to an invisible grid structure. Yeah. And of course, halftone images are the precursor to the digital image. So on
pixels,
our screens,
right,
we look at images that are broken into tiny pixels that cohere through optical illusion, very similarly. And we're all aware of the pixel grid, but we've also been trained to navigate the digital world essentially by ignoring it.
I wonder about the art historical critical establishment, especially in the 20th century, how it understood the importance of the grid. You mentioned Martha Rosler.
Well, many artists have pointed this out and called attention to the grid and its presence in mass media, sort of reappropriating advertisement, looking critically at advertising itself as a way of seeing that idea that John Berger also talked about. The 1970s was a really important moment, too, for really calling attention to this, especially in conceptual art practices. And within art history, I would say this has been most prominent in the study of design and visual culture history. So the topic of the grid in mass media has been really important for histories of graphic design and for historians of visual culture who study mass media. So I really wanted to bring these together with examples of modernism, modernist printmaking, like minimalism, pop art, op art, and then bringing those together with avant-garde photography, conceptual photography, and then the contemporary works that I mentioned, to really think more broadly about why the grid has had such a hold on Western culture and what tensions it brings to the surface.
Interesting. I was just lecturing to my freshman writing seminar on allegory, and we were looking at an early moralized Bible, and on the front page of the Bible was an illustration of God creating the earth, and he has a giant compass, of course, you know, because everything is geometrically designed.
Right.
So, you know, it was perfect, and I have pointed my students to the grid show here.
Oh, great.
We were reading Edna St. Vincent Millay's Renaissance, and she starts it out with sort of nursery rhyme. All I could see from where I stood was three long mountains and a wood. I turned and looked the other way and saw three mountains in a bay. And then she repeats that several times until it becomes monotonous in a way. And then she undergoes this total collapse, mental collapse, because of the way she's looking. You know, so it's a critique of this kind of Cartesian view of reality and language being tied to that. And then she becomes expressive, and she has this rebirth into this kind of Eden of a garden that she imagines. So anyway, I don't know where I'm going with this, but there's a lot about the grid to dislike, isn't there? I suppose.
Right. Yeah. Well, I love that example because something that comes up over and over with artists, I think especially, is the grid is this kind of constraining structure that sort of invites us to break out of it, right? It is a set of rules that we then want to break because we're human. We like rules and we like constraints, but we also like to mess with them.
I grew up in an industrial suburb, and everybody had cyclone fences, basically those wire fences that were, you know, 3 and 4 feet high. Between their yards, the backyards especially. So, you know, you'd look down and you'd see these grids on the landscape, and there was something so confining and constraining and territorial about that in all the ways. So,
yeah, we need boundaries, but we also need to push against them always.
Interesting. So how have artists themselves responded to the constraints of the grid, I wonder? And the show's about that to some extent, isn't it? And you use a term called the critical print that I thought was an interesting term in the catalog.
Yeah, so the term critical print comes up in the catalog, actually, in John's essay.
Uh-huh.
He writes about it in The Print After Photography.
Yeah.
And this is the idea that artists in the 20th and 21st century have called critical attention to the role of print media in reinforcing the values of Western culture, particularly Western capitalism and imperialism.
Yeah.
And I want to read a quote from John's essay because I really love the way he puts this.
I love his writing too.
His writing is amazing.
Yeah.
He says, "Artists have used various strategies, the moiré effect, deliberate misregistration, enlarged halftone dot patterns, to force the visual logic of commercial processes to the surface, so to speak, making visible the deliberately hidden grids that underlie patterns of advertising, marketing, and consumerism." So for me, one of the starting points for this topic were conversations with contemporary artists.
Uh-huh.
I started with the most contemporary works and worked backwards,
uh-huh,
thinking historically. And I noticed that so many artists today are turning toward geometric abstraction in looking critically at the exclusion and discrimination embedded in dominant Western culture,
uh-huh,
and in thinking about what a more expansive understanding of culture would look like.
Uh-huh.
For example, one artist in the exhibition, Rhiannon Skye Tafoya, is a printmaker and a book artist of Eastern Band Cherokee and,
uh-huh,
Santa Clara Pueblo heritage. And she says that she likes working with abstract forms because she gets to decide what means what.
Uh-huh.
That meaning is self-determined rather than externally determined.
Uh-huh.
So this is a really strong thread among a lot of contemporary artists' work, particularly who are embracing geometric abstraction.
Uh-huh.
This idea that abstraction can be a means of self-determination.
Uh-huh.
So I really love that idea.
Yeah, that is interesting. You've got statements about the grid all through the exhibit, don't
yes.
you? It's great, you know, and the labels on the walls. All these artists talking specifically about your subject in the exhibition, so it works really wonderfully. So, okay, so should we take a little stroll through the gallery?
Great.
So we can take our handheld recorder? So before we even get into the gallery, you have a preview of the grid here with a work called Grid, right? Martin Klein,
yeah,
yes.
By Martin
Wonderful.
Klein.
Yeah.
It was a work that I had considered for the show. It's not a printed work. It is
yeah,
a work
it's
on paper.
Paper, yeah.
And it's
like
very
watercolor,
large.
Is it? Yeah.
Yeah,
it's a,
yeah. Exactly. Watercolor and gouache.
Yeah, beautiful.
Yeah.
So, okay, we'll head in. We're in the gallery now. First question, how do you have the show divided? You've got three big bays to work with, yes?
Yeah, and actually a little entryway.
Yes, uh-huh.
So I wanted to use this entrance as a way to preview a bit of what the show would be.
Mm-hmm.
So we have our amazing lenticular typeface on the
yeah,
title
really
here.
Really beautiful on the wall, yeah.
Yeah, I love the way it translates
yeah.
to the space.
Uh-huh.
So you already get a sort of taste of this idea of having to look closely
uh-huh.
to be able to read or see what you're seeing.
Yeah, or look far away. So
right,
yeah.
or sort of reorient your body
yeah,
in some
yeah,
way. And
yeah.
then there are two works that kind of complement that idea.
Uh-huh.
One by Jesus Rafael Soto and one by Bridget Riley.
Uh-huh.
So two examples of op art in the collection. We have a great collection of op art here
uh-huh.
at the Loeb.
Yeah, there are pieces I never knew about here that came up out of storage that I've
yeah.
never seen before.
A few things
so, yeah.
I think that have never been shown before.
Yeah. If not everything is in Vassar's collection, most of it's in the Loeb collection, and some of it comes from special collections in the library.
That's right.
And we have a full archive, or as full as we can have, of works by the Women's Studio Workshop,
exactly.
so which
yeah.
has wonderful stuff,
yeah,
plus
and
other
we have
stuff.
A,
yeah.
We also have a small complimentary exhibition of books from Women's Studio Workshop
uh-huh.
and a few pieces of ephemera, which was a great collaboration with Women's Studio Workshop and with a student, Carissa Colson, who's
oh.
wonderful,
uh-huh.
Current Vassar student.
Yeah, it's quite nice. So you have works in the exhibition itself from the Women's Studio Workshop here nearby in Rosendale. And then you have this little kind of entry exhibition before you go into the show.
Exactly.
Yeah, wonderful. So
yeah, so we have this kind of preview with these disorienting optical illusion pieces
uh-huh.
that give a little taste of the idea of kind of going off the grid,
uh-huh.
that we're
yeah,
going
okay.
to be on the grid as much as we
yeah,
are off
okay,
the grid.
Yeah, okay, makes sense.
So then we enter the first gallery,
uh-huh.
and I have
two groups of work that I hope are sort of talking to each other in this space. One is a kind of selection of objects from our photography collection, from some of the earliest photographs in the collection.
Yeah, almost a history of photography here.
Yep,
isn't
all
it?
The way to one of the most contemporary works in the collection.
Yeah.
And really kind of sampling of, I think, some of the highlights of the photo collection. And just really thinking about all of the ways that the grid has structured the materiality of photography. So, you know, from the contact sheet to the negative strip to all of the ways in which photography is circulated in grids, presented in grids, down to the photo albums that we make at home. We don't have to put images in grids, but we do that
anyway. We do, yeah. You have a nice example here with the little colored corners that we used to use to glue them onto the construction paper. Yeah, wonderful. And the MyBridge here is really wonderful, isn't it? And he's using a grid, I suppose, like a film strip almost, although...
Yep. He's the proto-cinematic photographer.
Yeah, that's true, it seems like, yeah.
Yeah, and for me, this is kind of the touchstone for thinking about this way that we use the grid to organize information and to kind of conform the unruliness of life into boxes.
manageable.
Like creates this graph paper behind the
human figure. Oh, I see, behind the boxer throwing a punch, there's a grid.
And tries to make these photographs as kind of empirical as possible.
And every photograph, every part of a punch, basically, that he's showing you, has its own little box that that frames the motion like a stop time. So.
And we wouldn't necessarily... know to read this as a sequence unfolding in time if this wasn't something that we do all the time.
Well, that's
so
interesting.
Often that
we learn
how to do it. This is what Berger means by seeing as a learned behavior.
Yeah, you know there's a time element here, and you need to read it like that.
Yes, and we know that because we look at images like this all the time.
Yeah. Below it is a nice historical piece, too. The calling cards.
Yep.
By Desdary of a young woman. They're on a grid also. These would be chosen, I would suppose, by her. Like, this isn't really a contact sheet, is it? Or is it something like a contact sheet?
No, so the photographer was one of the most successful portrait photographers in Paris in the kind of mid-19th century, really made a booming business out of portrait photography. And he invented a camera with multiple lenses that would take pictures in succession and expose them all on the same negative. So it was really a kind of quick way of making
multiple images. Oh, that's interesting. So it's like if you want a good shot with your iPhone of yourself, a good selfie, you just boom, 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 and then you take the best one. I've noticed that. Or you could even do video and choose a video seat part.
So these would have been cut into six individual cards, mounted on a little card, and those become the calling cards.
Yeah.
And maybe she would have chosen her favorite, or maybe she would have taken all of them. But they would have been cut into separate objects.
Yeah.
But we get this amazing sort of snapshot of the process of making portrait photographs, and I love all of the different poses.
Yeah, me too. And her hairstyle's a little different in each of them. So
I mean, she really demonstrates how we sort of perform for the camera all the time.
And then you have classic names in the history of photography, Alexander Rodchenko and Man Ray.
Yes.
The Ray is really interesting to me in that it's a negative, isn't it? It's a series of exposures of different objects, not at the same time, I'm guessing.
So he made a photogram using objects that were variably opaque or transparent, and then he re-photographed that photogram.
I see. Okay, interesting.
So that's what we're looking at, the negative.
Yeah, interesting effect he has there.
Yeah, and then Rodchenko is also, you know, he's thinking about the negative, obviously.
Yeah.
And this sequence of images, one on top of the other.
Two shots of a young woman with her dog. One, the dog is just looking at her, and then the next one, the dog has jumped up on her knees here, and it's looking right in her face. But beautiful photograph. Looks so contemporary, you know, considering it was done in
1927.
So do you have favorites? Well, this one, I can give you two. I really like this. That is Jared Bark. And that's one of his photo booth photos, yes?
Yes.
It's wonderful. And talk about an abstract, but it's not just an abstract. It's something he took in a photo booth.
Yeah, so he kind of played with what he could do with the photo booth strip.
Yeah.
And made this abstract composition of images of his body where he really abstracts the body completely.
Yeah, his hand, right, and then his chest, I guess, torso form the center blocks. But yeah, it's wonderful.
The thing I love about this piece is he's showing the kind of absurdity of the human form conforming to that little box.
Oh, I see.
But that's also what happens in the photo booth.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So it happens in the photograph, but that's also when you squeeze into that photo booth.
You don't tell the booth when to take the photo. It takes it when it wants to.
You have to conform to this very strict, confined space and confined time.
And then it shoots you, you know. Yes, so,
yes, exactly. Yeah. And then a piece by Athena Tacha, which is also one of my favorites in the collection.
That you used to advertise the show, I remember the years. She taught at Oberlin, is it?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. She taught at Oberlin for many years. Athena Tacha works in many mediums, but this piece, she photographed the ears of each photograph is a different student at Oberlin. So I really love this because I learned that from our files here at the museum, that she was working on the piece and she was checking in with the curator here and said, I'm almost finished, but I need to wait for my students to come back from break because I don't have enough ears. So she was kind of collecting their ears.
Oh, I see. Oh, that's so funny. That is funny, huh?
And really just poking fun at this idea that you can collect parts of the human body as specimens, right? Which is, of course, what we do in scientific illustration all the time.
Yeah, or in science in jars, right?
Right.
So,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. So some nice examples of, especially in the 1970s, conceptual photographers playing with this idea of the grid as a way of organizing images.
Yeah, this is really a kind of critique, especially,
yes,
I think.
Absolutely.
But it's kind of fun. And it's interesting, actually, to see all those ears. It's funny, our ears are peculiarly shaped,
but
when you see a lot of them together, you see the peculiarities.
Exactly,
yeah,
exactly. And this is what we do with the grid. We compare things.
Yeah, well, that's true, yeah. And then you have the photo book, beautiful photo book here, of scenes from...
They're all mailboxes.
Mailboxes. Oh, from Maine mailboxes.
Yes,
yes. Yeah.
Yes. So this, just this great photo album of mailboxes.
Yeah, very strange. They're all so wonderful, you know.
Every
when you walk in, everything
story.
Is excited, yeah. And it's so colorful, too. You've got a stereoscopic images with an old stereoscope on the wall that visitors can use interactively.
It's actually like its own work of art in the show, this viewer, because it is modeled after a period stereo viewer from the 19th century, but it's made by a contemporary artist.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah.
I thought for sure it was an old piece of equipment. But,
it was commissioned for the exhibition, and we'll be able to keep it so that we can use
the
stereographs.
Yeah, Susan Koretsky used to have one up in her office you could have used. But
I have the stereographs next to this contemporary piece, which is using expired photo paper. This is a work
of Allison Rossiter, wonderful. It's just paper, right? Just photo paper.
Just photo paper. She collects expired papers from many decades ago. These were from the 1930s, so almost 100 years old. And she develops them just as they are. She doesn't further expose them. And she thinks of them as these little time capsules.
Yeah, well, they do have some kind of image on them, shadow anyway, of something that was there.
Exactly. So these little marks left through
traces,
time.
Traces, yeah.
That is just captured in emulsion. In that paper.
Yeah, great idea.
Love this work. And it's a great transition to kind of the other side of the room, which is looking at more minimalism.
So you've got both Stella and LeWitt side by side here, really quite nice, because they do talk to one another a bit.
So two kind of giants of geometric abstraction in the mid-20th century using these derivations of grid forms in their work.
And just on the other side, outside of the show, on the other side of the gallery, is Albers' homage to the square. Yeah.
Yep.
So, yeah, this is
exactly.
Great.
Exactly. Albers could have certainly been part of this conversation in this room.
Yeah. And then the LeWitt is wonderful here also. Five forms derived from a cube.
Yeah, so LeWitt is really, I think, one of the artists who immediately jumps to mind for most people when you say the grid in art.
Right? Yeah. I had a friend who was the librarian of the Walker Arts Center, received from LeWitt a $500 matching gift to buy artist books before anyone knew what artist books were.
Mm-hmm.
So she started that collection
Amazing.
There, and it became a kind of world-famous collection. So,
wow.
I always think fondly of him for that act, as she did, certainly. And then this is one of my favorite pieces, the Harry Callahan. It's so simple, you know, just mostly line.
Yeah, three photographs by Callahan.
Yeah.
And I really love these together because we have this almost total abstraction of the telephone wires.
Yeah, uh-huh.
This grid of telephone wires. But even that grid is a kind of imperfect one.
Yeah.
And then we have this weed against the sky.
Yeah,
this beautiful,
it looks like Queen Anne's lace, what's left of it, probably in the wintertime.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So this kind of suggestion, I think, of breaking out of the rigidity of the abstract line.
Yeah. It's also talking to drawing here a lot, isn't it? Because they're perfect lines. They look like they're drawn lines.
Absolutely.
So.
I feel like he's thinking about Talbot.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
The pencil of nature. Right?
Oh, yes. Okay. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Henry Fox Talbot. That's it, right?
William Henry Fox Talbot. Yeah. I always mess up the two first names.
And then these are wonderful, too. You've got two photographs, straight-up American documentary photographers, Walker Evans and Aaron Siskin, and their images of the facades of buildings. One just showing a window with the squares in the window by Walker Evans, beautiful thing. And it's just cut like that, isn't it? I mean, that's the whole photograph. So he knows what he's doing here. He's looking at the grid intentionally, isn't he?
Yeah.
And then Aaron Siskin looking at, I've seen this scene a million times in New York, looking at boarded up windows on a large building.
Look at grids all the time.
We do, beautiful.
Yeah. So certainly in the tradition of documentary photography, there are many, many grids.
So
Solowit.
Yeah, another Solowit. Yeah. Oh yeah, and Walter de Maria. I really like this.
This
I couldn't tell from the catalog how large it was. It's rather small, isn't it?
This is small.
His high energy bar.
Yes.
And it's really just a chrome bar.
Yeah.
But just absolute perfect purism, you know, that you get
from.
That's
the idea, I thought Walter de Maria, was really important for thinking about this idea of the grid as a pure form, right? Or the cube, or the square
cube,
as a pure form.
Yeah.
He's certainly interested in that.
Yeah. Here I thought we would just pick out a couple of things, but we're going through everything, so I can't.
There's so many interesting things to look at.
Okay, so you've got Lichtenstein. We're in the second bay now, and you've got Roy Lichtenstein kind of almost dominating the whole wall devoted to his untitled Still Life with Lemon and Glass from the portfolio for Meyer Shapiro.
Great prints.
I mean, it's absolutely perfect.
There's
this kind of perfection that goes into, an attempt at perfection that goes into a lot of these works, isn't there?
Yeah.
I get that certainly in Ed Ruscha's artist books. So.
For sure. So this room is really about those invisible grids that we look through but not look at.
Uh-huh.
So the halftone grid and then the typographic grid.
Oh, okay, great. So.
So Lichtenstein, you know, sort of looking at the way images are broken up in lines or dot patterns.
Yeah.
Through Benday dots.
In the catalog, someone mentions Dorothy Seiberling asking if Roy Lichtenstein is actually an artist.
The worst artist in the world.
Oh, the worst artist in the world, Now, I should say Dorothy Seiberling is an old Vassar grad and knew what she was doing. She introduced Pollock and Rothko to the world in a way through Life magazine as the arts photographer. So she can't have been possibly serious.
She was being rather tongue-in-cheek.
I think so. But I think she's quoted at length in the catalog,
I believe Bart.
Bart quotes her,
And she's given another work, actually, in this section of the show.
Oh, she has.
To the collection. This lenticular postcard is one of my favorites.
Langenstein?
Michael Langenstein. So you can, if you get a little bit above or a little below, you can see
it. Oh, I see. You
effect.
Can see it, You can see the effect. That is really interesting. It's an interesting piece because it shows the World Trade Center juxtaposed with the pyramids, probably in scale in a way. So it shows you how tall the World Trade Center was. And this was done then in
the 1970s,
so not long after the World Trade Center was built, long before, you know, there was any conflict with...
Very different moment to look at those buildings.
It is,
But yeah, he's
all living happily together with the pyramids here.
Perfect geometric forms.
Oh, that's so true. They are, aren't they?
Yeah, both the pyramid and the towers.
Yeah, and there's a wonderful Andreas Feininger figure of the body here in a kind of... Is that a moiré pattern or not quite?
It's called reticulation, this technique.
Okay.
So this was something that often happens in the darkroom by mistake, and Feininger found it really interesting and then kind of cultivated it on purpose. So it's when the emulsion gets extremely hot or extremely cold, it
creates this puckering effect, and that is then something that he made kind of all over the surface, and it looks like the halftone pattern, right? It looks like a dot pattern, but it's created in the darkroom.
Oh, I see. Interesting.
So I thought that was an interesting thing, since most of the works here are using the halftone are printed on a press, right? Not in a darkroom.
Yeah. And then this is great, the R.B. Kettai in our Time Photo Eye. Very strange, almost reminds me of the Man Ray a little bit. It's got some typography in it.
Well, you're right on, because Kitai's series in our time is making screen prints of some of Kitai's sort of most beloved books in his collection, the book covers. So he kind of blows them up to this monumental scale. And the book cover that he's reproducing here is called, the book is Photo Eye. It was printed in the 1920s, and the image on the book cover is by Elizitsky.
So is it? Okay.
Contemporary Man Ray, kind of avant-garde figure. And I just love this because the image is printed as a halftone on the book cover, and then he runs it through the screen again and turns it into this screen print and sort of further atomizes the image, right, through screen printing. And then the book itself is really about what photography is, and photography as a way of seeing, right? So the photo eye is the kind of core idea of this book. So,
and there is a compass in it also, so.
Yeah, Lizitsky was this, you know, master architect and typographer and all these things, and so he's made this great composite portrait of himself.
And then the Stephen Fraley here is a nice piece too. It's just a diptych. I love the hats. I have photos of my own hats hanging in Tremblou in Paris like that, but beautiful color for photography, and strange juxtaposition as a diptych. So you've got the hats and a shutter on the left side with blue mainly, and then with a kind of gold you have on the right two figures that are a kind of shadows almost in a door frame with a little light chain. So
So did you notice how some of the image has a halftone dot pattern and some of it does not?
No, I did not, no.
Yeah.
I did know something odd about the hat, but I just assumed it was the fabric of the hat. But it's a halftone.
I saw these and I just was really perplexed because I saw this dot pattern, but the photographs are both large Polaroids.
Yeah.
So I didn't really understand what I was seeing, and I asked the artist to explain this to me. And it was a long conversation, but very enlightening. And basically he created these by enlarging a couple of 8x10s that were film stills. So the image of the hat and the hat rack and the two figures behind the door, he had them enlarged so that you get that dot pattern, and then he re-photographed them in his studio behind the shutter and behind the little pull cord.
An actual piece of reality.
So you get this sort of tension around, you know, is photography showing you what's there, or is it about reproducing images?
Yeah.
And Stephen is very interested in that tension between the two functions of photography.
So I just love
this piece.
There's kind of an alighting too between the representation and the actual thing that is a representation also, but it's also reality in a way, you know, between fiction and fact, I suppose you could say.
Absolutely. There's a quote on the wall that is from Stephen Fraley's contribution to the book, where he talks about the grid translated into dots and pixels is the DNA of reproduction, which is, he's really speaking my language here.
Great. And then we have this huge vitrine with some of my favorite pieces in them. One, I've always loved this since we got the thing, Abracadabra by Werner Pfeiffer. Lives up north of us in Rhinebeck. I had a show in the art library, kind of birthday show, our inaugural show in the art library, actually, when we renovated. Master typographer and typographic artist. So that you're stunned when you see him, and if you don't know who he is, you ask yourself, why don't we all know who Werner Pfeiffer is?
He's an incredible book artist and typographer.
And we've had him on the show talking about his
great
work.
Yeah.
A wonderful conversation that was. So.
Yeah, he also contributed a text to the book. He, of course, writes about the typographic grid and the tension there to want to break it, which, of course, he does.
Yeah, I think he started the graphic arts program at Pratt. Mm-hmm. He's one of the people that started up there. Yeah,
amazing.
So, and then Ruscha, I'm so glad that the Pfeiffer work is in here with the Ruscha. It's one of my favorite works. So, and we got this actually from Rosemary Furtak at the Walker when she was selling off her own personal collection before she died. So, Yeah, that's Rouché's Every Building on the Sunset Strip, 1966, and it is literally, it's a Leporello that shows you a long, long panorama of every building on the Sunset Strip. So,
All of the works on this side are thinking in different ways about reading and looking and what the differences are, how we read versus how we see. Werner Pfeiffer calls our attention to the idea that letters and words are also forms.
Yeah,
they're images as well.
Yeah,
But we know that we're supposed to read them instead of just look at them until they're turned into abstraction.
Yeah.
And Ed Ruscha does that as well, right? Makes us read and look and kind of negotiate the two.
And also the Lozitsky and Mayakovsky book here, the title page.
Book.
Yeah, me too. I think this was just floating around in the art stacks for years and years, and we we noticed that it was there, and I sent it over to Special Collections.
Yeah, I pulled it out and was like,
"Oh, you did! You pulled it out of the stack, so you pulled it out." Okay, I thought I must have.
I think I just like pulled it.
Yeah, well, hopefully it will go back to Special Collections and not
so.
To the art stacks.
Hopefully, my label will put it back in its place.
Yeah. And I like this, George Brechtig.
Yeah, this is an artist associated with Fluxus. So really kind of making a game out of art making, much more interested in process than outcome.
Yeah.
And, you know, creating this little word game with tiles that we have to kind of interpret for ourselves.
Yeah, do you put them together however you want when you mount them?
That's a great question.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, do we read it as a word? Do we read it as a phrase?
So
That's up to you.
Like Scrabble, right? So,
yes, it is like Scrabble.
And this is a stunning thing, this Lozitsky.
It's one of my favorite prints in the
crown
collection.
From the Kessner portfolio of 1923. So it's typographical on some level, isn't it?
Yes, he's really using type pieces as abstraction.
Yeah.
So turning them, physically turning pieces of type on their
ends
or on their sides to create these abstractions.
Yeah. And there's graphic design involved here too.
And it's very sculptural, right? Yeah. It really suggests 3D space.
So the barbed wire photo, Lucas Feltzman.
I like it.
So
I love this work.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, he really brings out this idea that when we see what looks like text paired with an image, right? Although these are both images, but one of them, it almost looks like you're
reading,
opened a book,
and you have,
and the pieces of barbed wire are presented like lines of text,
and the camera
turns them into that.
Yeah, or musical notes.
Yes, musical notes.
And then you've got an image on top that they seem to be referring to. It's like a caption.
Yeah, for him, he really loved, again, this theme of kind of confinement and breaking free of confinement. He loved the kind of wildness of the landscape paired with this bizarre taxonomy of barbed wires. And he found that display of barbed wire in a little roadside museum in Arizona.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I love that. And so he just photographed it exactly as it was, as a kind of ready-made.
From the Museum of Barbed Wire, seems like.
Something like that. Yeah.
And
you probably know this piece.
Yeah, Tim Yude, he was here pounding away on his typewriter. I don't know if this is our piece, but
it is
Mary McCarthy's the group.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So, of course, this has to be part of the
collection. So he typed over and over the whole novel on one piece of paper until the keys demolished the interior of the paper.
Exactly. Yeah. So it turns it into this kind of sculpture.
Yeah.
I mean, when I say words can also be images, right, that he turns words into abstraction
and
into sculpture.
Yeah.
And Thomas Barrow, another artist really playing with this tension between reading and looking, you know, turning a scrapbook into a photograph.
Yeah. Beautiful images.
Yeah, so many amazing works from the 1970s especially.
Yeah. Okay, so that's bay two. And we'll move into the last bay. The bays are a grid, aren't they? You're working in a grid. Yes. Yeah. Well, look at the floors. Yes, they're a grid. But the bays themselves. When I do these interviews, we're always dividing the show up into three parts.
Yep.
You know, because there are three squares that the stuff goes into.
Yep.
Three
the
rooms. So yeah,
that
it
we
is. Yeah.
Exist in.
But you do try to mitigate against that to some extent in an exhibit, in that you don't paint the walls just white anymore, right? So you can neutralize the effect of the grid a little bit.
Yeah.
Or at least play off it with paint. So,
exactly.
Yeah.
So the final room is just one section of works that are interrelated.
Yeah.
There are some great examples of op art from the collection in conversation with much more contemporary works. So some of the most recent acquisitions to the collection are in this
here,
room.
Yeah. And it's called Disorientation, Reorientation, Grids Fall Apart. And then we start out then with another Bridget Riley. There was one on the way in. This was a 71 piece, print for Chicago 8, Conspiracy, the Artist as Witness. So quite beautiful thing.
Yeah, really great optical illusion here. We're really just looking at a sequence of stripes of equal width, but they don't appear as such because of the way that the colors are interacting.
Yeah, I see.
Completely disorienting.
Yeah, it is, yeah. Yeah, it is.
Really fun and beautiful print.
Pushing against the grid in big time.
Absolutely. Yeah, so most of these artists are pushing against the grid or trying to kind of repurpose it in some ways.
Yeah. And this is one of my favorites. Susan Silton's Infested, number 11 from the series Infested.
Yeah.
So she's taken photographs. Are these Polaroids, giant Polaroids? Or are they?
No, they're
chromogenic prints.
Just very large.
And they're of buildings in California neighborhoods that have been covered over because they've been infested with insects, and people are trying to de-infest them by gassing the place, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
But they're really colorful covers, aren't they?
Bizarrely, so, they're like these
circus tents almost.
Yeah, or Cristo sculptures.
Oh yeah, they are. Yeah,
like
Cristo,
Renegades.
They do.
Yeah, and Susan was just sort of fascinated by these forms.
Yeah.
And
so anyway, it's a beautiful thing, the colors.
So she was really struck by these kind of bizarre circus tents and was also interested in a history of stripes being used as a sign of social deviance.
Yeah,
in
the Middle Ages,
exactly.
They start out very much that.
Exactly, and Susan herself identifies as a queer artist, and she's thinking about how one positions themselves in a history of art and of culture that has been one of exclusion. And so for her, that's what the stripe signifies, and kind of that history, right? It's not about minimalism or abstraction. It's really a different history.
Yeah, different kind of thing,
Yeah, but I love this kind of monument to the termite infestation tent.
it's great.
Yeah.
And then this is on the cover of the catalog, isn't it? This Aaron Turner, Questions for Saul, from the series Black Alchemy, Volume 2, done in 2018. So can you talk about this? Because it's an important piece, I think, right?
Yes, of course.
Conceptually.
For me, it's a touchstone for the whole show, which is why it's on the cover of the book.
Okay.
So Aaron's practice is really fascinating. He uses photography and abstraction to kind of sort through history, questions about his own personal history, but also the history of art, the canon of art history. And here he is taking different reproductions of works by Solowit and projecting them in different ways in his studio, making a kind of ephemeral light installation, and then he re-photographs that. So what we see is this, I think, somewhat disorienting composition. You can see the kind of tape marks where images or reproductions of images have been taped together. It's a little hard to tell what is in the foreground or the background. And the title, of course, refers to Solowit, and he's really asking questions about what it means for himself as a Black American artist to be working in abstraction, how to kind of make space for artists who historically have been expected to make figurative work, to represent their culture in a specific way. And Aaron is an abstract artist, and there's, of course, a long history of Black artists and artists of color working in abstraction.
Yeah.
People like Alma Thomas and Howard Ina Pindell, some of his heroes, where while someone like Solowit, you know, has become a canonical figure, those names are not as known.
So
he's really also asking those questions.
Yeah.
Why is that? And how does an artist working today reclaim abstraction for themselves? So for him, working in abstraction is very much about this history and his place in it.
Yeah. Interesting. And Eduardo Perolazzi, Italian pop artist.
So he's, you know, that quote that I read from John's essay about bringing those dots to the surface and really calling critical attention to popular media, that's Paolozzi's wheelhouse. The two prints that I chose for the show are more abstract. Mm-hmm. He's often kind of sampling images from popular culture and incorporating those into his prints. These are, yeah, a little bit more more abstract, but I just loved the conversation between these and some of the contemporary pieces.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, they're really striking pieces. They really hold together. This kind of perfection about them.
I love these, too.
Yeah, me too. And then this is a recent acquisition, isn't it?
Yes,
it was just in one of the galleries behind us, the Leslie Hewitt. So, beautiful thing. Conceptual piece, yes?
Yeah, conceptual photography, post minimalist, thinking about this history again of abstraction. And Leslie makes these ephemeral studio installations, these stacks of photograph on top of a piece of printed matter like a book or a magazine on her studio floor, re-photographs them, and then create these monochrome photograms that are paired together.
Yeah, it's a kind of diptych.
It is a diptych, and she's thinking about the relationship between these two images and how we as perceivers will hopefully put together these images and think about their relationship to each other.
Yeah, interesting. Something is a lot more what it is if you have an understanding of what it is not. Yes, so she has, you know, the blank black square next to it. So, and then you've got Marcel Duchamp's retro reliefs, and you have it on the screen here as well. Yes, so
yeah, we have a little video of them spinning.
Yeah,
and then a few of them in a case. You know, really thinking about how abstract form can create this sense of disorientation
and sort of dizziness
when you look at them, especially in motion.
Yeah, very beautiful, though.
Yeah, I love these objects.
Yeah, me too, yeah.
And then they're in kind of conversation with a couple of other op-related pieces by Victor Vassarelli and Reginald Neal.
Uh-huh.
Reginald Neal is really playing with this moiré pattern, this glitch that happens when lines intersect in just the wrong way. Right, we see this on our phone screens all the time with digital pixels.
Yeah.
And it's quite disorienting when you move around.
It really
appears to move and change.
A little bit like the lenticular photograph.
Exactly.
And then you've got another case full of wonderful stuff. Some of this, if not all of it, is Women's Studio Workshop
all
material.
Of it.
Yes,
yeah.
Is it? Okay.
Exactly.
More typography.
Two of the founders of
the Women's Studio Workshop, Titania Kellner and Ann Kalbach. They contributed then to this piece?
They made this piece together.
Uh-huh.
And I love this because there's actually one of their earliest pieces made at Women's Studio Workshop in the gallery at the front of the, show.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a nice conversation between a more contemporary work and a work from the 70s.
Yeah.
So lots of artists playing with this structure of the book, structure of the typographic grid, you know, orienting the book as a kind of sculpture that can be turned and looked at many ways.
Yeah.
This book by Ann Thompson is kind of a sculptural object.
Yeah, it is. It's a beautiful thing.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Anything on the other side? No, I guess not. So we're almost through the last bay here. So we have, of course, Dwayne Michaels, big name, and one of his more famous pieces here, the Dream of Flowers. Beautiful, beautiful thing.
I love this work.
Yeah, me too. But it's a sequence in a sense, isn't it? Like the things that we were looking at the beginning of the show, of a man slowly being buried with flowers. Yeah, so.
Yeah, this beautiful elegiac portrait, and he's really doing something quite different with the idea of images in sequence in a grid.
Yeah.
Right, turning them into this kind of memorial and just this beautiful kind of meditation on a life.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And then this is, I think, one of the stronger pieces in the show, Stephanie Sajuko.
Stephanie Sajuko is a wonderful contemporary artist. This is one of our most recent acquisitions, too.
Oh, is it? Yeah. It's called Cargo Cults.
And
it's a photograph.
It's a photograph. It's a self-portrait of a sort.
Uh-huh,
it is the artist posing in the photograph.
Uh-huh.
She is really taking her cues from ethnographic photography.
Oh.
She's thinking about this convention of ethnographic portraiture, which of course was made by white photographers.
Yeah, it was a way of classifying people by racial groups.
Yes,
yeah,
and you know, often turning a subject into a kind of fiction.
Objectifying,
and an object.
Taking away
the
subjectivity, yes.
And so she's sort of bringing in some contemporary themes like global fashion. So
uh-huh,
the clothing that she's wearing is all purchased from the mall, places like Target or
Forever
21.
Yeah.
So you can see the tags are still on clothing because she intends to return it. She's not trying to like feed the global market here. But there are all these so-called ethnic patterns, right? This is the way in which these ideas about other cultures, the exotification of an other happens in our contemporary culture is often through fashion. And then she's using this zigzag stripe pattern in the background. She's interested in what was known as dazzle camouflage in World War I, this practice of painting warships in bright colors, not unlike the fumigation tent in Susan Silton's photograph. So they would paint these ships in contrasting striped colors that would disorient other ships. It would be very hard to tell how far away
they were and what,
And so similarly, the stripe pattern is a kind of disorienting device here where you have trouble visually distinguishing figure from ground.
Yeah, it does function that way for sure.
And for her, it's this sign of this false subject that you're trying to find. You won't find her because this is a fiction.
Yeah.
Right?
She's camouflaged.
So I love this repurposing of the stripe pattern.
Yeah.
I think this is really ingenious.
Yeah. And then last but not least is the Tafoya here piece.
Yes, this wonderful book by Rhiannon Skye Tafoya.
And it's an artist book, yes.
Yeah, beautiful artist book.
And it's a Women's Studio Workshop piece.
Yeah, also made at Women's Studio Workshop. One of the most recent books made there in 2020.
Oh.
She made this beautiful woven paper object.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the dyes are natural dyes, and the patterns are taken from Cherokee basketry.
Uh-huh.
So she's thinking about the traditions of her own family, traditions of language, of craft, of making baskets in particular, and then translating that into bookmaking.
And these are geometric also, though.
Yes, you know, the patterns, this is another example of geometric abstraction has many histories. One of them is Indigenous American culture, many Indigenous cultures, right? And so she really embraces abstraction as this symbol and conduit of her own culture, her own family, her memories, and her sort of personal experiences. And so I just love this book so much. It's an amazing object.
Yeah, it is, And it's really a sculptural piece. It folds up and makes a little house almost, doesn't it? So
yeah, and you can sort of manipulate the pieces anyway.
Oh, you can.
I had to figure out how I wanted to show it, which is tricky because you want people to just be able to play with it, but of course that's not possible.
Yeah, you couldn't. Yeah. Okay, so we're through the galleries. So that was great. So one last question. There's a program, a speaking program coming up in the near future on the exhibit?
Yes, we have a public reception and a talk with the artist Aaron Turner, whose work, of course, is in the show and on the cover of our book. So that will be on Friday, October 7th. The reception starts at 4:30. The talk is at 6 p.m. Here, the reception in the galleries, and then the talk just nearby in Taylor Hall on Vassar campus.
Okay, wonderful. So I just want to thank you finally, Jessica, for talking to us about the exhibition On the Grid, Ways of Seeing in Print here at the Francis Lehman Loeb Art Center through December 22nd. Yes?
Yes.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay.